KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment. Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. So often, movies, be they fiction films or documentary, deal with the idea of truth, either creating a truth or asking questions about the nature of truth and the subjectivity of truth and the subjectivity of memory, really. And my guest, Bart Layton, has made a documentary about this and a fiction film that deals with documentary footage in this. His new film is American Animals First. Bart Layton, thanks so much for being here.
Oh, thanks for having me.
And talk a little bit about the title, because it's such a great title.
Yeah, I wish I could take more credit for that. It actually came out of, so it's a true story about the theft of some of the most valuable books in the world. And I read about the story, this is a long time ago, and at the time, the perpetrators of the crime, the more I read about it, the more kind of bizarre and unexpected it became. Because the perpetrators of the crime were a group of young men, fairly well-educated young men at good universities.
And solid middle-class citizens, we should say, too.
Yeah, yeah. And kind of upper-middle-class kids from Lexington, Kentucky. And one of them was at one of the oldest liberal arts colleges in America. And in that university, there was a special collections room. And in that special collections room are the most valuable books on the planet, including Birds of America, you know, the volumes by John James Audubon, and The Origin of Species by Charles Darwin. And so there was a great kind of irony in the idea of them stealing this book about, you know, evolution and about how human beings have evolved. And there was a great quote in it about American animals and domestic animals in particular, and how Darwin was observing that, you know, over centuries, domesticated animals, particularly dogs, you know, he witnessed a drooping in the ears, you know, because, you know, they no longer have this need to be alert in the way that wild animals do, obviously. And so a lot of what the film is about these young men who are kind of lost and desperately in search of an identity, and also in search of an experience of life that feels kind of real to them, that feels authentic, that feels like it's going to give them a shot of what it really feels like to be alive. And so there was this whole, you know, I mean, running through the movie, there's a kind of Darwinian sort of streak, you know, not least because of the books that they try to steal, but also this idea of, you know, have we evolved to a point where we're no longer really equipped to survive, like in the Darwinian sense, we're really well equipped to kind of buy packaged goods and consume and tweet and go on Facebook and all the rest of it. And so that was one of the things that led me to the title, and also the fact that, you know, they start as well-educated young men and they ended up behaving as animals. Yeah,
it's interesting too, because we had you with LACMA just last week talking about this, and obviously the one of the scenes, especially hearing you talk about the Darwin stuff, is Fight Club. And also just these guys trying to keep themselves awake and alive. And the pop music used in the film is really about sort of charging yourself up. I think about that great Johnny Thunder song, I'm Alive, which are basically screaming at the top of their lungs at one point in the movie. And it's a song really about sort of trying to just be alive as a kid. And that, in fact, one of the kids' dads even says, you just got to pump yourself up. And the idea of pumping themselves up in this almost empty, hollow way reminds me a lot of Fight Club.
Yeah, it was weird. You know, the whole script was written based on these letters that I was exchanging with the real guys when they're in prison. And one of them said in one of his letters that it was like their own version of Fight Club. He said
he said that.
Yeah, he did. And he said it was a book that had a huge influence on him. But he said it was like the secret that they had, you know, that they were living these fairly I guess, what he saw as sort of predictable lives. He, Eric, the guy who said this, was at that point doing an accountancy degree and training to join the FBI. And a number of his family members were in the FBI. And he said that having this, you know, what they were doing, which was trying to plan the perfect robbery. And I don't think they, I'm not sure they ever really thought they were going to end up going through with it. I think they fell in love with the fantasy. And that was the thing he said. He
said, even at one point, Eric even says that he kind of got into this just to sort of regain his friendship with one of the guys in the group.
Exactly. You know, they all that was the fascinating thing. I guess that was the thing that made me think it was a story I wanted to tell, because they each had very bizarre and different motivations for the crime. You know, one of them, who is sort of the central narrator, I guess, is he talked in his letters about having...
And that's Spencer.
Spencer, yeah, being desperate to become an artist, you know, and that he had read about all the great artists that ever lived, and the one thing they all had in common was that they'd experienced terrible suffering,
yeah.
You know, and that they'd known tragedy and they'd had enormous difficulty, you know, and he talked about, you know, his different, you know, de Kooning and, you know, all of these different artists that he admired and how they'd struggled. And he said, you know, my life was never going to put me in the path of anything resembling an experience that was going to give me anything worthy of making art about. And so that idea, you know, I think I said to you the other night, you know, that idea of a central protagonist whose main problem is that he doesn't really have a problem, but he feels like he needs one in order to have a story to tell. And that just seemed like such a great, an unusual starting point. And also something that felt strangely relevant, you know, this increasing pressure, I guess, in our culture to be remarkable, you know, that we live with these devices that help us broadcast constantly, you know, and like, and then our importance in the world is then related to how many people are interested in what we have to say or whether we're remarkable in some way. And so a lot of that felt like it was part of the motivation for these guys doing what they did.
It's the treatment. We're talking about the gossamer idea of American exceptionalism with the director and writer of the film American Animals, Bart Layton. I guess as we're talking about this, though, one of the things that we can look at The Imposter and look at this film, the idea of, and I think this is a particularly American kind of thing, you tell me if I'm wrong, the idea of people looking for a story, a narrative to build around themselves, looking for, in fact, we were just talking about this before we got started, a myth to fasten themselves to, a greater story, something that's almost like a thing that's been passed down in some way, is this thing that attracts you in thematic terms, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think, I'm not sure if it's totally an American thing. I think it's becoming more of a cultural thing. I did an interview in Seattle at the weekend with this really smart young college journalist, and she said, you know, we were talking about it, and she said, God, you know, the film, she saw it with some friends from university, and she said the film was so close to home. She said there's this real feeling amongst her and her friends that if they don't have a Wikipedia page by the time they're sort of 40, will that mean that they're not successful? And I think with this, there's this idea that it almost doesn't matter whether you're, and I sound like an old person saying this, but I there's this sort of sense that it almost doesn't matter massively what you're known for or what you're famous for or what the mark is that you leave, as long as there's a mark, as long as you can be Googled and you know, your face come up somehow. But I also think, you know, it's like that line in that Daniel Johnson song, you know, wouldn't life be more interesting if we were all in the movies? You know, what these guys were doing was trying to kind of inhabit a movie fantasy that just ended up going way too far. You know,
as I mentioned to you last week, the movies that they start looking at to study, because there is no book on how to rob a library, are a bunch of heist films, most of which end up in failure.
Yeah, I'm not sure they, you know, I think, you know, they went to Blockbusters and, you know, rented every heist movie they could, but I'm not sure they made it to the end where, as you say, most of them end very badly, yeah.
In fact, there's a film that they're watching at one point in the film that is a film that ends in failure.
Totally, yeah. I mean, the other thing about those movies is, you know, I think most of those heistmen, you know, you need to get on board with whoever it is that's committing the crime. You know, if, you know, that with Danny Ocean, I guess his...
It's the are you in or are you out moment, which is echoed here, except yeah. Eric says, well, I need some time to think about it, which is what a real person would say.
Yeah. And also, you know, they don't really have a proper reason. You know, they don't, it's not about the money. If, you know, I always felt like if they did even think they were going to get away with it, what did they imagine they were going to do with the money? I mean, where were they going to hide it? How were they going to, you know, did they really think? And I don't think that was the plan. I think, you know, like I say, they were in love with the kind of the planning of it and this sort of Fight Club secret that they had. And then they got to a place where they realized they'd planned it so well, they probably could get away with it. And then they, and then it becomes this sort of existential kind of question, which is, what does it look like if we do this? If we cross the line, you know, nothing will be ever be the same again. And I think the knowing the answer to that question was the thing that became kind of all-consuming. You know, they got to a place where it's like there's a crossroads. One, you just pull the ripcord and say, you know, let's stop this now before it goes too far. And then you return to your, you know, otherwise predictable life. Or you do this other thing and, you know, the only thing that's guaranteed is, you know, nothing will ever be the same again.
But the thing about those heist films too, and this gets to even Fight Club a little bit, is there's this romance of this bromance, if you will, these guys getting together and that idea, this thing bringing them closer, which is, again, another myth that they seem to be sort of dialing into as well, isn't it?
Yeah, totally. I mean, you know, I was, when we were casting the film, I was working with a really brilliant casting director called Avi Kaufman, and she called up and she said, you know, this is such an amazing group of characters. The thing I can't quite figure out is what is it that unites them, because they're all very different. You know, you've got one who's an artist, and, you know, and he really is an artist. He did all of the artwork in the film.
And ironically, ends up living a life not unlike Audubon.
Yes, now, totally.
He goes to prison and then becomes a painter.
Yeah, absolutely. And then, you know, and then you've got this kind of charismatic, lunatic leader, and then you've got the sort of straight guy who's sort of more of a jockish character, I guess. And, you know, and the only, and she was sort of saying, what is it, what I can't figure out is what is it that unites them? And I think the thing that united these four guys was they were all sort of in love with Warren, who's the Evan Peters character. And he is just this magnetic guy. He's one of those, you know, we all know one of those people, but most of us aren't. And he's that person that, you know, when you're around, trouble is likely to ensue. And I think they all just wanted to be in his orbit.
It's a treat. We're going to take a break. We're talking with the writer, director of the great new film, American Animals, Bart Layton. There's more to come. Stay with us.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes. Join Jacqueline Coley as she hosts a brand new podcast, Scene on Screen. Meet the innovative people at NBC Universal as they share their journeys, inspirations, and the movies that define them. Each episode is an intimate and fun conversation about the impact of film. Scene on Screen is available now, wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
It's a treatment. We're worrying about how the show's going. My guess is the writer-director of American Animals, Bart Layton, I think is going well, because that last third, which is what I brought up to where the filmmaking craft really comes into play, is it's just, in so many ways, a very playful film. You're playing with our reactions to having the fourth wall broken. You're playing with the idea what documentary is. You're playing with the idea what fiction film is. You're playing with the idea of how real people are used in stories about themselves. At one point, putting Warren and Evan Peters in the same car having a conversation about how this thing is going and what memory really is. And the last third, that that energy, that juice that's really kind of the province of young people goes away and it's replaced with, it's still adrenaline, but it's the adrenaline of anxiety. I mean, it's the use of pop music to sort of crank us up and put us in this great mood disappears. The score becomes discordant, orchestral. We get a real sense of you're using sound design. There's a constant thudding and this sort of scraping and people breathing. That idea that once the physical danger is introduced into this, and the idea of hurting somebody physically, bringing pain to somebody, which is something these guys dance around for the entire 2/3 of the opening movie, and somehow think they're going to be able to get, because in the movies you never really see anybody get hurt, or anybody who doesn't deserve to be hurt get hurt, and the idea of bringing physical pain to someone who's completely undeserving really throws everybody off.
Yeah, and in a way, I guess the form and the grammar and the look and feel, and even as you say, the sound of the film was designed to, I guess, mirror their journey from, you know, we start in a place that feels quite naturalistic. It's this sort of suburban, sort of teenage wasteland of, you know, that kind of limbo place where kids don't really have a place to be.
And there's even one point where Spencer and Warren are watching kids basically who could be them.
Exactly.
Just killing time.
Yeah, just wasting time. And, you know, and I was, you know, I didn't grow up in the US, but I, you know, I did a lot of, you know, research, and I spent a lot of time in the place where it really happened. I kind of asked, well, you know, what do you do when you're too young to be in bars and too old to be at home and stuff? And, you know, they hung out in these sort of, you know, in strip malls and setting fire to stuff and kind of mucking around and, you know, doing donuts in cars. And it's this idea of, you know, just wasting time. And, you know, and Spencer talks about just this feeling of waiting for something to happen. And then what happens is when they start in on this idea of planning this robbery, we slide stylistically closer to the movies that they're referencing. You know, the color palette starts to change, the score, you know, there's more, you know, big commercial tracks, you know, there's more of a kind of sense that we as an audience get to go with them into the adventure, you know, and that we're also, against our better judgment, we're kind of rooting for them to do this very ill-advised thing, because we also want to know what happens on the other side of that line. You know, most of us are never going to do anything either foolish or, you know, daring enough to know what it looks like to throw your whole life up in, you know, play Russian roulette with it in that way. And there's a point in the movie where we go a long way into, you know, we go much closer to the tropes of the slick kind of Ocean's 11 type heist movie. And the idea with that,
you even played out using a song from Ocean's 11.
Yeah. And, you know, and there are a lot of very specific references, because those guys were actually watching those movies as a kind of reference point for what they were doing. And then there's a very clear point where we bump, or we kind of crash back into reality in a really brutal way. And that was always the intention, that we would suddenly be thrust into quite an uncomfortable place where we realize, oh, you know, I have also been slightly rooting for these guys to do this thing. And
because in heist movies are rooting for these guys to do these things too.
Yeah. I mean, there was an intention to keep the audience questioning, you know, where they are. You know, whenever you shoot, you know, a documentary interview, you know, obviously there's a vogue for, you know, these very neutral backdrops and all the rest of it. But often, you know, you get as much information about that character from, you know, the place. You know, it's a portrait, and, you know, all of their environment tells you a lot about who they are. And with this, I kind of wanted to, I guess, keep the audience guessing as to, you know, what actually, how did this play out? You know, that is the thing you're constantly asking yourself, I think, as you're watching it. And also, you know, the idea of including them in the film is to sort of, I guess, increase your emotional investment in not just them but the story, because you're never allowed to kind of drift off into movie world where the consequences don't really affect you. You are absolutely, like, you're connected to them, they're real people, you're constantly reminded that it's really happened. And so I think, you know, it's interesting watching the movie with audiences who watch. There's a whole section of it where they like people slide down in the seat and they're watching it through their fingers because it's really, really hard to watch.
It gets brutal.
Yeah, it gets brutal and it gets very, very tense. And I think part of the reason it is so tense is because you've met the real guys. You know that this isn't just a movie. This is, you know, it really happened.
It's true. We're talking about grammar, both verbal and filmic, with the director of American Animals, Bart Layton. But I think you even sort of offer this up a little bit to us because you're talking about Birds of America, and the painting Birds of America figures into this montage at the very beginning, which is, it's the one painting of Audubon's I know because it's so violent. And just those almost subliminal glimpses of that painting really kind of offers, in thematic terms, of what we're going to see, doesn't it?
Yeah, exactly. And there was so much. I mean, you know, whenever you look for things that echo the themes you think you're playing with, you know, you can always find them. But I guess there was a lot in the Audubon book. And also because that book was, it came, you know, it was made at a time when I guess America was a lot wilder. And, you know, we talked a lot about, you know, situationism and, you know, that great slogan that they used to have, which was, you know, under the pavement lies the beach. And there was a sense with these guys that, you know, what they were looking for was their own journey into the wilderness. I mean, you know, one of the other books and movies we talked about was Into the Wild, you know, which was the story of Chris McCandless, who was actually not from a dissimilar background to these guys.
And looking
guys.
For the same kind of experience that they
exactly,
were looking for.
Exactly, you know, and what he did was he went, you know, into the wild in order to confront himself with, I guess, his own nature and all the rest of it.
And was as ill-equipped as these guys
exactly.
are.
Exactly. And what they did seemed to me in some ways to come from a similar place. It was obviously a much more destructive and, well, probably equally self-destructive act, but it was a much more kind of destructive and selfish act in many ways. But it felt like it came from a similar place. And that whole thing about Audubon and the wild and what he did, you know, I think Spencer, you know, who wanted this experience of a trip into the wilderness, he looked at Audubon, and Audubon spent time in Kentucky as a young man, went to prison briefly for bankruptcy, and then went off into the wild with a gun and some paint.
Yeah.
And
that's what I was saying. Basically, that Spencer's ended up really echoing Audubon's life. He went to
totally.
Prison and came out as a painter.
So yes. In my mind, he didn't just want to steal the book. He kind of wanted to steal that version of himself. You know, he wanted to steal that identity for himself. He wanted to be Audubon. He wanted to know what, he wanted to find his kind of purpose as an artist.
It's funny, I don't know if you know the movie or the book Deliverance, but it's a great film by John Boorman about this same kind of thing. In the book by James Dickey, who was America's greatest poet, who I think wrote the greatest novel ever written by a poet, is about the same kind of experience. I mean, a bunch of suburban guys who just want to have this kind of weekend away from the trappings of comfort, and again, these guys being completely ill-equipped for it, and having a thirst for something that is only an abstraction, is not a real thing, and going from the abstract to the concrete of this is where the danger lies. And I guess in watching this, who again, I just, when you saw that painting Birds for Americans, I thought, this is the movie.
Yeah, I mean, I obviously went to the university where it happened. I was shown around by the librarian who was...
Still the same librarian?
Yeah, still the same librarian who was taken, you know, hostage or whatever. And she showed me the books, and they are totally remarkable. I mean, I hadn't figured on how massive they are, but also they are like... It's a book full of paintings, full of incredible works of art. And it's really striking. It's and you can kind of see why they felt that it was worthy of, you know, planning this incredibly elaborate robbery. I think the thing they hadn't quite allowed for was the fact that they weigh a ton. you know,
they're huge
and they're massive, and so you see all of that play out in the film. You know how they planned it within, you know, an inch of its life, but what they haven't quite allowed for is, you know, the weight and the size of the items that they're going to be stealing.
I guess, though, this brings me to a question that I have, especially if we talk about what you might do next. This idea for people of not weighing the real-life consequences of amorality, not immorality, but amorality, and until, I mean, in The Imposter, I mean, he's kind of playing with this all the time, but he never really asks himself these questions. And these questions of where morality sits, because the novel Fight Club is very much about that. I mean, crossing these lines. And the idea for you of civilized people, we'll take this back, incredibly comfortable civilized people whose lives are defined by their comforts, crossing these lines stepping over these lines is really something that weighs heavily for you. And I wonder where that comes from for you as an artist, because it's clearly something that tickles something in you.
Yeah, I think, you know, I think with The Imposter, it was a very different set of motivators that were driving his behavior, I think.
But still that idea of amorality plays
but
a
yeah,
big part
I think,
this.
But also people's ability to justify their version of why it's not amoral, what they're doing. You know, I think with him, you know, with The Imposter, in his mind, he felt he'd never really had a childhood. You know, he was a guy who, who basically was born into a family that didn't want him because of his, you know, he was half Algerian and all the rest of it. And then he felt somehow that it was legitimate for him to steal someone else's childhood, steal someone else's identity. And he just had a deeply sort of selfish streak that allowed him to justify everything. I think with these guys, it's a slightly different thing because, you know, to worry about whether you're interesting or not, or whether your life is special, or you're going to be important, it's a totally privileged concern, isn't it? I mean, think about the hierarchy of needs, you know, am I going to be important or special? Is right down there. You only get to worry about that if you've got all of your other needs covered, essentially. And I think that was the thing that, and, you know, in terms of what I relate to, you know, there was a part of, you know, I think I probably had a more tumultuous upbringing than Spencer did. And yet, you know, there is that thing where you think, well, you know, what is it that as an artist you're going to, you know, it's always write about what you know or make art about what you know. And there was something of, you know, Spencer's desire to, I guess, have something traumatic happen to him in order to have, you know, a story to tell. I think there's something that, you know, as artists, you sort of feel like probably that was an incredibly naive idea. You know, he could have just gone off to art college in New York, or he could have done.
Or don't people used to do exactly? You go, you backpack across Europe for a summer, or
and
something.
And weirdly, you know, when I went down to Lexington and I saw where they lived and I saw that environment, you know, it's a much more sort of sanitized, it's very sterile environment in some parts. And I think he probably was just, you know, he was only 20 at the time, and he was just naive about, you know, what the opportunities were that were open to him. And I think he thought he needed to do something radical in order to find that thing that was going to give him a voice.
You've got to come back again, Bart. It's great talking
to
you.
Hey, no, this has been such a pleasure. Thanks so much.
My guest is Bart Layton. His new film as director and writer is American Animals. The show is recorded at NPR West by Josh Newell. It's mixed by Kat Yore. It's edited by Blake Veit. I have a Wikipedia page. It's not that big a deal. It's The Treatment. Catch up on past episodes of The Treatment, go to kcrw.com or listen on your smartphone with KCRW's mobile apps, or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or if you listen to podcasts. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.